An unknown, terrifying specter, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. What was meant by this mysterious prophecy nearly 2,000 years ago? And why has that phrase become one of the most accurate descriptions for modern-day conditions? Why do newscasters and even political leaders have to go to the Bible to come up with words like Armageddon or apocalyptic? This is the second program in a complete series on the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse and what they mean to you in this modern space age. Their message is one of the most frightening of all Bible prophecy. You need to be informed and prepared. In the heart of the Cheyenne Mountain, where the defense systems of the United States are relatively safe and buried deep underground, there is a piece of electronic communication gear that people refer to as the Armageddon button. A science fiction writer recently produced a book called Doomsday, 1989. A PhD who wrote in Scientific American as far back as 1970 focused in on the problem of nuclear proliferation and the resultant possibility of the war that he called to end all wars. And he stated that he felt civilization and mankind had only about a 50-50 chance of making it to the 1980s and none at all to the year 2000. All of this begins to sound very much like Jeremiah or some of the prophecies of Isaiah or Jonah or even John in the book of Revelation, which is commonly called the Apocalypse. Now, originally, apocalypse merely meant a writing to reveal the future. It means to unveil that which is hidden or concealed, even though in common usage it has come to mean, in most people's minds, the idea of terrifying conditions of a nuclear-armed world. And prognosticators are now finding that they have to look into the pages of the Bible to find prophecies or concepts pandemic enough to describe the modern 20th century in which we live. So now in this second part program of the four-part series on the Four Horsemen of the Book of Revelation, we'll examine in detail the second horseman described by John in Revelation, the sixth chapter. It says, and I quote, beginning in verse 3, "When he'd opened the second seal, I heard the second beast say, 'Come and see.' And there went out another horse that was red, and power was given to him that sat thereon to take peace from the earth, that they should kill one another. And there was given unto him a great sword." Prophecy links the four horsemen with the perilous conditions known as the end times, of which Christ spoke elsewhere in the Bible. Now, there's no ambiguity whatsoever with the red horse, no mysterious wonderment about exactly what that horse means. It clearly is stated to mean war. It was exactly 0227 a.m. on the island of Tinian, August 6, 1945, when a big B-29 weighing more than 65,000 pounds and using every available foot of runway barely staggered into the air on that mission that is now so famous when Enola Gay was airborne on its way to Hiroshima. There was a crew of 12 and a single bomb aboard, a cylindrical bomb, a large one called Little Boy. In one instant of time, over the middle of downtown Hiroshima in Japan, 100 million degrees centigrade heat was released in a searing flash. Instantly, within a half mile of ground zero, everything, people, horses, carts, houses, even stone, was changed. People were disintegrated, buildings, carts, and houses evaporated, and people, believe it or not, even left their indelibly immortalized shadows burnt on pavement or bridges where they stood while their entire being simply disappeared. The brightness of that flash so fused the elements of stone itself that it changed the color of rock. In gravestones in Hiroshima, some of the mica of the stones ran just like glass and is still there and can be witnessed to this day. In that brief instant, 100,000 human beings were either killed instantly or died later. 13,937 people were missing and still are, and 37,425 people died later of wounds, were horribly disfigured. In some cases, their survivors, with these odd-looking cherry-like bulbous growths on their body, may have continued to live for many years in pain and suffering to finally die. Others were instantly rendered sterile. In that one moment, an equivalent of more than 20,000 tons of TNT had been unleashed. 11 days after the United States had dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, the editor of U.S. News and World Report, now deceased, David Lawrence, told us that we'd entered a new age. I quote his words at that time. He said, "Man has at last brought forth a weapon that reduces war to an absurdity. A single airplane, riding high in the stratosphere, unobserved and undetected because of its great speed, can appear suddenly over London or Washington or Detroit or Pittsburgh or any city in a peaceful area and destroy human lives by the hundreds of thousands in just a few seconds. No longer are armies and navies or even air forces by themselves an adequate defense." He said, "We have been brought face to face with stark reality that wars cannot afterward or hereafter be tolerated, and that peoples must never again allow a one-man government to exploit them and drive them into war." End of quote. One study over 15 years ago estimated that in the 5,500 years of written human history, man has known only 292 years of peace, which translates into a meager 5% of man's recorded history. The history of warfare is the history of relentless marches toward greater destructive power. From the time of the ancient mighty Roman legions to the destruction of Hiroshima in 1945, weapons have become increasingly more complex and deadly. Every new offensive weapon has bred a countermeasure, some method by which that weapon could be overcome. And so each one is a whistle or a signal to go out and develop yet a more terrifying offensive weapon, in turn a better defensive weapon, in turn another offensive weapon. The Civil War was the first war in which American ingenuity made itself felt on a wide scale. It brought about improvement in rifles and artillery and saw the introduction of ironclad ships and all-metal vessels. World War I also saw an explosion of devastating innovations in warfare. The airplane became a weapon of warfare for the first time. Dogfights became commonplace. Aerial bombings threatened civilian populaces in a way that no other weapon ever had before. The submarine came into its own during World War I. Landmines were developed. The tank made its first appearance. And importantly enough, poison gas, though not perfected, was used in World War I. World War II saw a tremendous increase in the devastating trends initiated by the First World War. The tank was perfected. Aerial bombing became more devastating and more precise. Witness the destruction of the cities in the Ruhr in Germany during World War II. The aircraft carrier became a reality. The oceans no longer afforded protection from air assaults. The United States developed rocket warfare in the form of the bazooka. The Russians developed rockets. Germany did. The buzz bomb, the V-1, the short-range intercontinental ballistic missile, the V-2, that went clear up into outer space and back down. The Germans developed the jet aircraft. The Italians had jet aircraft. And so did the Japanese, believe it or not, and the United States was not far behind. But all these were completely overshadowed by the weapon used to end the war in the Pacific, the atomic bomb. Because man's knowledge builds on itself, each new development is just that much more sophisticated and destructive than the last. Each new war more devastating than the last one, even though they become ever more impersonal, ever more scientific, and aimed at total civilian populations. The casualties in World War II were twice again what they were in World War I. Worse, the proportion of civilian casualties in modern warfare is going up. Roughly 50% of the deaths in World War I were civilian, but in World War II, the figure was more than 70%. The whole trend of the 20th century has been to do away with the little niceties that served to keep the casualty rates down in the past. Mercenaries, whose primary concern was often to avoid battle so they could collect a paycheck, were replaced by conscripts who were whipped into a frenzied moral passion against the enemy. Anti-personnel weapons such as gas, napalm, the concussion bomb, and others have been developed. And most important of all, the trend of the 20th century had been to blur the distinction between soldier and civilian. Nuclear weapons, particularly with the lethal fallout that comes after the initial flash and explosion, all but obliterate whatever distinction there used to be between the two. It's utterly impossible to say you aim a nuclear weapon at only a civilian target. The one thing we have got to avoid, statesmen continually say, is nuclear war. But as we're going to see, mankind is on a headlong rush toward a nuclear war before the end of this century, and that is the very essence of the meaning of the red horse of the apocalypse.
Pioneer 10 races out of our solar system while religious war rages in Northern Ireland. Politicians search for peace while pollution engulfs our planet. The gross national product of the United States exceeds $1 trillion, while over 15,000 people starve to death worldwide each day. In this age of paradox unparalleled, where can you turn for understanding? There is a source that answers the frightening questions of the 20th century. It's called The Plain Truth. This magazine of understanding reveals the meaning behind today's world news and shows you the good news beyond. Today, more than ever before, you need The Plain Truth. For your free sample copy of the monthly Plain Truth magazine, call toll-free 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.
Let me send you your free copy of the Plain Truth magazine right away. Just pick up the telephone and dial that number you saw, 800-423-4444. The Plain Truth is absolutely free, and of course even the telephone call costs you absolutely nothing. Well, is nuclear war inevitable? It certainly is unthinkable. No one wants to even begin to admit into his mind that we are headed in a year and a half or 2 years or 5 years or even 10 years for some Armageddon-like nuclear bomb war in the last part of this century. I've been accused of being a prophet of doom, but I cannot make certain facts go away. I did not produce those facts. I did not create them, didn't bring them into being. But if I look into the Bible and I see in these horsemen of the apocalypse prophecies the threat of all-out war, of devastating calamities that are going to affect the entirety of mankind, and then I'm able to read the statistics and the data and the newspapers and the magazines just like you are, and to see hard, substantial facts that are there and will not go away, I may as well tell the truth instead of telling you they do not exist. Man's history is filled with atrocities, with oppression, exploitation, and greed. So let's be specific. The reason the United States has a nuclear arsenal equal to the explosive force of more than 600,000 Hiroshimas is because we feel that if we didn't, we'd be at the mercy of the Soviet Union. And indeed, we would be. The 1968 Czechoslovakian invasion shows us that the current regime in the Kremlin is not afraid to use its tremendous military power to get what it wants. And what it ultimately wants is a world under Soviet domination. So stop and think. If the Soviet Union could get away with attacking anybody in the world, anywhere, at any time, and get away scot-free, do you think the Kremlin wouldn't at least threaten to do it for political purposes or go ahead and do it? As long as one superpower is able to at least match the other in nuclear arms so that the leaders know that the country will receive what is called unacceptable retaliatory damage, should it ever initiate an attack, then the odds are in favor of a kind of a gray, nebulous peace between that war which must not be fought and the total peace which cannot be achieved between the superpowers. But a spiraling arms race could mean that one nation could pull so far ahead that it might be tempted to launch a nuclear attack. The other fact is even more frightening, because the risk of nuclear war increases dramatically with a number of countries which possess nuclear weapons. By 1984, there will be up to 28 countries with enough nuclear power to produce 10 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs per day. Put another way, it takes only a dozen pounds of plutonium to produce a nuclear bomb. The world's nuclear reactors are already creating plutonium at the rate of about 45 tons a year. And the awesome fact is that there is now enough plutonium outside the United States and the Soviet Union to make over 1,500 small atomic bombs. At this moment, while the world's superpowers are technically at peace, at least four of these hotspots have the serious potential to erupt into actual nuclear war in the very near future. The first one is obviously the Middle East, festooned with weapons of every kind, and it's now common knowledge that Israel possesses at least a few atomic bombs. Is there any doubt that Israel, whose survival carries so much symbolic meaning to Jews worldwide, would not hesitate to use nuclear weapons if its very survival were at stake? The second potential nuclear hotspot is South Africa, a country which, a lot like Israel, is for the most part surrounded by potentially hostile nations, much more numerous in population, and which have questioned the very right of that government to exist. The third trouble spot is Central Europe. A lot of debate going on about that question. Some military authorities believe that NATO troops are so hopelessly outnumbered and outgunned in that region that should the Soviet Union ever choose to invade Western Europe, only tactical nuclear weapons could stop it. They don't think the conventional NATO forces could withstand the Warsaw Group forces there. The fourth major potential nuclear flashpoint is Korea. Tactical nuclear weapons are already in South Korea, and a full-scale invasion from the North would perhaps be the most ideal battlefield conditions under which to try to wage a limited tactical nuclear war. Well, what then is standing between us and a world armed to its nuclear teeth with nuclear weapons? It certainly isn't the International Atomic Energy Agency inspections and the safeguards designed to prevent a country from diverting atomic fuel from peaceful to war-making activities. Most nations are free, perfectly so, to thumb their nose at that institution if they choose. Furthermore, there may be entirely too much plutonium to track down. That fact was dramatically illustrated recently by the revelation from the U.S. government that they can't account for about 11,000 pounds of weapons-grade nuclear materials. And the United States probably has the best accounting system in that regard in the world. At the same time, it came out in the British press that enough nuclear material to make 15 atomic bombs is unaccounted for by the United Kingdom's Atomic Energy Authority. There's no way you can simply make a wish and the world's accumulation of plutonium will disappear. This world is producing more than 45 tons of plutonium annually, and it only takes 12 pounds of that stuff to make one nuclear bomb. It seems almost inevitable that somewhere, sometime, somehow, somebody is going to get his hands on enough of that stuff to build his own bomb, even some irresponsible little anarchistic dictator in a small country, and inflict nuclear destruction on whomever he chooses, whensoever he chooses, like some madman in some crazy movie is blackmailing the rest of the entirety of the world and would virtually have the United States at his own knees if he has so successfully concealed that bomb that there's no way to stop him. The hard facts of this world in which we live would conclude anyone to believe, if he really understands and knows what the Bible says about that red horse of the apocalypse in the sixth chapter of Revelation, that we now live in the shadow of that specter of Bible prophecy.
Because of the size and scope of a topic such as the Red Horse of War, the following booklet is offered. For your free copy of The Red Horse, call this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. Or you may write, Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. This complimentary booklet is available so that you may examine the source material of this program in greater detail. That phone number, once again, is 800-423-4444, toll free. Or you may write Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123.
This is what that little booklet looks like, and believe it or not, even a little booklet with a cover this grisly has a happy ending. So pick up the telephone and dial that toll-free number, and let me send you your free copy right away on the Red Horse War. Well, just because mankind possesses nuclear weapons doesn't mean that man will use them, is what some people argue, because after all, we wouldn't dare. But let's look at the track record of mankind after he detonated the first nuclear explosion at the end of World War II. The terrible fact is, according to the director of Stockholm's International Peace Research Institute, that there has not been a single day since the end of World War II where the world was totally free from war. On the average day since the end of World War II, six wars were being fought. It goes up into the tens of millions of people who have died in the wars of this world since the war to end all wars. More than 80 countries have been involved in fighting in our supposedly post-war era. We ought to rename it and call it the war-making era, because it certainly is not post-war. A typical day in 1951, for example, would have seen actual fighting in Malaya, Indochina, Philippines, Burma, Korea, Formosa, and Tibet. In 1961, fighting was going on in the Himalayas, the Congo, Venezuela, Colombia, Cuba, Goa, Kuwait, Angola, as well as Laos and Vietnam. In 1975, full-scale wars were going on in Lebanon, Angola, Portuguese, Timor, Ethiopia, and Thailand. Urban guerrilla war was being waged and still is in North Ireland and Spain. Guerrilla fighting going on in Argentina, Oman, Yemen, Mozambique, and Brazil. You can look all over Africa, Central and South America, Asia, the periphery of Southeast Asia, and wars are going on practically everywhere, practically all the time. Jesus said in his Olivet prophecy of Matthew 24 and verse 6 that one of the great signs that you would be living in an end time, the time of the culmination of our civilization as we know it, and the beginning of a new and a different civilization, not doomsday, not the end of the world, but the sign of his imminent return to take a hand in world government would be wars and rumors of wars. Now, rumors of war, well, think of the fact that all over the world when the austere scientists and geologists and physicists and scientists of every stripe get together in these think tanks where they try to think about the dwindling non-renewable resources. They try to think about pollution and overpopulation and urban crowding and just all the problems of humankind. Inevitably, they talk about the fact that the chances of war are greatly increasing. A few years ago, a group of arms experts at MIT made the flat prediction, nuclear war in some form is likely to come before the end of this century. It will probably occur as a direct result of a proliferation of nuclear powers and weaponry. The more people who have such weapons, the more probable their use, they said. And very recently, a two-day conference of United States and Canadian scientists on the world's arms buildup concluded that, and I quote, the world will be involved in a nuclear war before the end of the century. Christ said you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars, and that's what your newspapers tell you about. But a skeptic might say, well, haven't wars always been going on around the globe? And won't they always be? And don't they tend to control each other or burn out just like a brush fire left uncontrolled? Well, yes, that's partially true. And yet Bible prophecy says that wars would take on an increasingly destructive character as the time of the end approaches. The Apostle Paul warned Timothy that in the last days, perilous times would come. He talked about the nature of men, the disintegration of our societies. When you think of perilous times, there are estimates that the total amount of nuclear firepower in the world is so awesome that there is perhaps 30 tons of TNT explosive power for every last man, woman, and child on the face of the earth. Perilous times? Well, today the world's armories contain multi-megaton weapons which have more destructive force than all the conventional explosives ever used in warfare since the day gunpowder was discovered. The U.S. arms stockpile is equal to more than 620,000 of those bombs that destroyed Hiroshima, and the Soviet arsenal is even larger than that. And while strategic analysts debate over whether a nation could ever fight and win a nuclear war, there's no denying that man now possesses destructive weapons far different and far more devastating than he ever had in the past. Revelation 9, verses 18 or 15 through 18, seem to speak of a gigantic war in the end times, which would involve armies of maybe 200 million, in which a third part of men would be killed. And now, for the first time in all of history, man has weapons which can destroy great masses of people at one time. Consider that most of the Soviet Union's ICBMs are armed with 1 megaton warheads. A study was once made of what a single 1 megaton warhead would do to a city of 1 million people. Within a radius of about 2 miles, everything would be destroyed unless it were protected by reinforced concrete. For another 4 miles, it would be partial or complete destruction of buildings, and the immediate human casualties would be about half or 50%. On top of that, there would be heavy destruction of buildings for another 6 miles, and 35% of the inhabitants would die immediately. All in all, 60% of the entire city would be destroyed, and that's just with one warhead. The Soviet Union has around 4,500 warheads. The Soviets also have a supply of 20 megaton warheads. If one of those were, say, to be dropped over Manhattan, 6 million of New York's 8 million inhabitants would die immediately. Another 1 million people would be killed beyond the city limits, and the explosion would make a crater almost a half mile in diameter. The book of Revelation also says that in those days men shall seek death and shall not find it, and shall desire to die, and death shall not find them. Now listen to this description. You wouldn't feel it at all at first, any more than you do an x-ray going into your body. It might be minutes, it might be hours, even days, and then some of the first effects would come along. You'd begin to feel dizzy, you'd feel nauseous, breathing would become difficult, it would be harder to walk and use your hands, little annoyances would tend to irritate you and set you off. If you had a cut, it wouldn't heal. You would begin to notice your hair is falling out, that your appetite had gone away. Weeks later, the symptoms would become stronger and stronger and more persistent. It would be hard to stop vomiting. Constant diarrhea you would be experiencing would turn watery and then bloody. Every breath would become an agony. Eventually, you would become delirious, lapse into a coma, and then you would die. The Bible says, seek death and not find it. And what I mentioned to you just then was a description of the effects of the ultra-modern neutron bomb from a report in New Times magazine. The neutron bomb is already developed and is slated to be deployed in Central Europe. But the neutron weapon isn't all. Gas or germ warfare might produce the same effects, which are nothing short of unthinkable and terrifying. Over and over again, we see that biblical predictions of a time of great trouble are increasingly characteristic of the day and age in which we live. We live in a unique time when man has developed engines of mass destruction which were never possessed by other generations. It is only in our day when man has the ability to actually bring to pass the prophecies of mass destruction found in the prophetic books of your Bible. Well, is there then no hope? Is this all a lot of doomsday talk? Shall we all rush off to our private cave and await doomsday? The Bible happens to talk about a time beyond man's wars when the world will enjoy peace and material abundance as never before. It also says that it's always darkest just before the dawn, and that finally, our civilization will be dramatically altered. It predicts a 1,000-year rule of great prosperity under the administration of Jesus Christ himself. A lot of people have the idea the dead go to heaven, that this is just a soul factory, people spinning off every day going up to heaven. I don't know how they reconcile that with the many, many chapters of the Bible and the dozens of statements about Jesus Christ coming back to this earth. But notice how this statement in Matthew 24 ties into what we've been hearing on this program. Quote, and except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. Moffat adds the word, no flesh be saved alive. That's talking about the salvation of the human race physically. It's talking about protecting human beings in a physical lifespan, not salvation, but saving mankind alive. Then Jesus said, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened, which means the days will be shortened by supernatural intervention at the second coming of Jesus Christ. And when that happens, Isaiah says, they will beat their swords into plowshares, their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not learn war. They will not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war anymore. That is, of course, the happy solution. If you will write for this booklet, or better yet, pick up the telephone and dial that toll-free number, 800-423-4444, you will see that in spite of the grisly cover, it does have a happy ending. Because the Bible says there is going to be a better world tomorrow, but not before man has become so absolutely at his rope's end that it's going to take a supernatural intervention of God to cut us down before we hang ourselves. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong.
For the free literature offered on this program, write Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. In Canada, Box 44, Vancouver, B.C. Or in the continental United States, you may call this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444. In California, dial direct 213-577-5225. All literature is free upon request.